From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Chris Drackwitz grew up in Germany, but he spent much of his adult life showing Americans their musical heritage. Strackwitz's record company, Arhuli, specializes in American regional music. On this edition of Fresh Air, Chris Drackwitz's world of blues, Tex-Mex, Cajun, and Zydeco. Also, cinematographer Ernest Dickerson tells us about his long collaboration with filmmaker Spike Lee. Dickerson shot all of Spike Lee's features and student films. And TV critic David Bianculli takes a look at a new CBS comedy show starring Dave Thomas of SCTV fame. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. In the Soviet Republic of Armenia, tens of thousands of people jammed a public square today to mark the anniversary of Armenia's 1918 Declaration of Independence. And, as NPR's Ann Cooper reports, they mourned those who died in fierce gun battles in the capital, Yerevan, yesterday.
Most of the dead were armed civilians killed in battles with Soviet Interior Ministry troops. Yerevan residents reached by telephone said it wasn't clear how the first attack began at the city's train station yesterday morning. Militants who fought there and on the city's outskirts had rifles, semi-automatic weapons, and Molotov cocktails. Interior Ministry troops returned their fire from tanks and armored personnel carriers. Leaders of Armenia's nationalist movement denied having any connection to the gunmen. Official Soviet news reports referred to them as terrorists with criminal records, but did not identify them further. Yerevan residents said they will mark a day of mourning for the dead tomorrow. I'm Ann Cooper in Moscow.
23 people died and dozens of others were wounded in the weekend shootout. Colombia's new president is expected to take a hard line, not only against drug gangsters in his own country, but against drug-consuming nations like the United States. Nearly completed returns from yesterday's election show Cesar Gaviria with 48% of the vote, twice that of his nearest opponent. Turnout was reported to be low after a campaign of shootings and bomb attacks that the government blamed on drug traffickers and leftist rebels. Gaviria told reporters that he intends to demand more economic aid from drug-consuming nations to support his war against the leaders of Colombia's drug cartels. The Irish Republican Army has claimed responsibility for the death of two Australians killed yesterday in the Netherlands. NPR's Jackie Lydon has this report.
The IRA in Dublin today said it was behind the slaying of two Australian men on vacation in Mormont in South Holland. The men, in a British-registered car, were mistaken for off-duty British soldiers. The IRA, which has killed before in cases of mistaken identity, said it deeply regretted the death and that the active service unit which shot the men accepted responsibility. The IRA's terrorist war against Great Britain has been stepped up this summer, both in Britain and on the continent. I'm Jackie Lydon reporting.
At least 22 people, including an opposition lawmaker, were killed today in ethnic violence in Pakistan. Most of the violence is reported in the Sindh province, the home area of Pakistani Prime Minister Benazir Bhutto. The shootings and sniper attacks are blamed on an extremist Muslim group that's trying to win political recognition for Muslim Indians who emigrated to Pakistan. Prime Minister Bhutto visited Karachi, where army troops have been sent to restore order. At least 60 people were reported killed in the city of Hyderabad yesterday when security forces fired on demonstrators. This is NPR News. Afghan government radio said today that a rocket attack by rebel forces killed 6 people and wounded 20 in the capital city of Kabul. The attack came as Afghan regional leaders assembled for what the government claims is a council to adopt democratic reforms. The rebels refused to take part in talks with the Marxist government of President Najibullah. Western analysts have claimed Najibullah's proposed reforms are largely cosmetic. In Poland, rail workers have agreed to end a walkout after holding an all-night meeting with Solidarity founder Lech Walesa. The BBC's Misha Glennie reports that the labor breakthrough will provide Walesa with a much-needed boost after weeks of growing criticism of the labor leader.
In recent weeks, Lech Wałęsa has been creating a political mess, which in the eyes of the public did little for his reputation. He has made disparaging remarks about the program of his former advisor, Mr. Tadeusz Mazowiecki. Most Poles have been deeply impressed by the steady governing hand of Mr. Mazowiecki, and they considered Mr. Wałęsa's criticism to be unfounded and born out of petty jealousy. This Friday and Saturday, the Solidarity chairman failed in his attempt to end the damaging rail strike, and many Poles began muttering that the old man had lost his touch. But he refused to give up, and last night persuaded the strikers to go back to work against the odds. Wałęsa may make ill-considered remarks in public, but there is nobody in Eastern Europe who can match his tactical brilliance in the heat of political struggle. The Solidarity chairman has proved once again that he remains the single most important actor on Poland's political stage.
The BBC's Misha Glenny. Iraqi President Saddam Hussein opened a two-day Arab summit today in Baghdad with a threat against Israel. Hussein said that if Israel deployed nuclear or chemical weapons against Arabs, Iraq would respond with weapons of mass destruction. The conference was called as a show of Arab unity against what the Iraqi president claims is a Western campaign against Iraq. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
There's a number we call the Zydeco Cha-Cha, baby.
That's Clifton Chenier, the late king of Zydeco, in one of his many recordings on Arhuli Records. My guest, Chris Drakwitz, is the founder of Arhuli. It's an independent record label based in California devoted to regional American music like Cajun, Tex-Mex, blues, and country. Drakwitz has traveled around America recording musicians in their homes as well as in clubs and in the studio. Drakwitz also makes documentaries about regional music with filmmaker Les Blank. Their most recent film about Cajun and Zydeco music of Louisiana is called J'ai été au bal, I Went to the Dance. It will be shown on PBS in the fall. This year, Arhuli is celebrating its 30th anniversary. We invited Chris Drakwitz in for a mini retrospective of his work. Though Drakwitz has devoted all of his adult life to recording the indigenous music of the U.S., he was actually born in Germany and came to California in 1947. He told me he first heard the music of the American South on the radio.
I think that was my first exposure to all of it. And I was absolutely wiped out by it. I guess I had a lot of insecure feelings. I couldn't speak the language. I was real skinny. And somehow the blues that I heard, I think, spoke to me the strongest. I'll never forget that first record by Lightning Hopkins. I heard, Hello Central, please give me 209. I want to talk to my baby. She's way on down the line. And it just blew me away. And I also loved hillbilly music. I heard T-Texas Tyler, the Maddox Brothers and Rose, and gospel music. I heard the St. Paul Baptist Church Choir over a station out of Los Angeles. All of that, you know, it was just, the radio was my ear to the world, so to speak. And I think part of my love affair with this music has been my love affair with meeting these other cultures.
When you started collecting records, where did you go to get them? I mean, I think a lot of people thought of 78s as junk that they'd just sell in flea markets or give them away.
Well, that was at that time the only kind of record. I was the only one in existence. It was a marvelous medium. And it turned out almost every kind of vernacular music was recorded. And I found out it slowly. I didn't have any money, but I would save my allowances. And once in a while, I could splurge and buy myself a 78. And I would wear them out, I can tell you that.
What made you decide to try to record people and meet the people whose records you were listening to and record new records by them?
Well, since I was so enamored with this whole idea of records and what's on them, you know, I always collected things and stamps before that, but records, you could hear what's in those grooves. And I guess I was simply amazed by it all. And when I came up here to Northern California, I met people like Bob Geddens, a black man originally from Texas who was recording here in the Bay Area. And then I met a man named Jackson. He lived on 7th Street in West Oakland. He was recording literally in his back room with one microphone and a disc cutter, you know, where you cut directly to discs. Those early 78s were all done that way. And I simply was amazed that this is all it takes. I first thought to make a record, you go into one side of a factory, you have a huge place, an artist goes in, and out on the other side come the records. But I had no idea what the in-between process was. And sort of meeting all these people taught me.
Some of the early music that you recorded was Zydeco music in Louisiana, at house parties, in bars. I want to play one of those early sessions. But before I play it, tell us what Zydeco is and how it's distinguished from, say, Cajun music.
Yeah, I didn't know what Zydeco music was either when I first went down there in 1960 or 59, so I simply asked people, what does Zydeco mean? And some of them said, well, it means snap beans, not salty. It's an old tune that everybody knew. Others said, oh, it's just going out in the country and having a party, going to the Zydeco, going to party and having a good time playing music, push and pull, you know, that accordion music. And so that's basically what it is. It's the music of the French-speaking Creoles, blacks, in southwest Louisiana, in contrast to the white Cajun music.
Now, I want to play something that you made in the early 1960s. This is called Tap Dance. It's by a group, McZeal and Gergner. Tell us where you recorded this, who they are.
Well, I'm really not too sure who they were. At that time, I was just wandering around and just asking people. You know, I was driving. And they said, oh, yeah, I met them somehow through someone else. And they said, we're playing a little house party. Come on over and join us, you know. And so I did. I simply went to this little house in Lafayette, I believe it was. And they played for me, and there was a bunch of people having a good time at the house. And they were very typical of the little Zydeco groups that were all over the place, usually just accordion and rubboard. In Houston...
Rubboard is like washboard?
Yeah, like a washboard. And at that time, they were still pretty much looked like a washboard. I later found out that some of them would take pieces out of an old icebox where there was corrugated steel in them, and they would cut out a piece that they can scrape on. Because the regular old washboard, see, that metal is much too soft. It just wears through in no time when you're scraping away on it with beer can openers and all that sort of stuff. So they were using a corrugated metal, steel metal, right off the bat. And now it's become a real fashionable instrument that was sort of invented by Clifton Chenier, or by his brother Cleveland Chenier, who was really one of the giants of the whole genre. And they went down to a guy once, Clifton told me, he said, I went down to the steel company and told him, can you make me one like this? And he said he drew it in the sand as to how he wanted it, with this collar on it that would fold back over his shoulders, you know, and then hanging in front of his chest. And they said, sure, we can make that. And that's how these rub boards were made that you see now being worn by almost all the rub board players.
Well, let's go to this 1961 recording that you made at a house party in Lafayette, Louisiana. Recorded in 1961 by my guest Chris Drakwitz, who's the founder and head of Arhuli Records, which is a record company that features regional music from around America and also music from other parts of the world. Had there been much Cajun and Zydeco music recordings made before you started making them in the early 60s?
Oh, yes, lots of them. Not much in the way of black recordings, no, but a lot of the first Cajun recording was made in 1928 by Joe Falcon. But in subsequent years, relatively little black material was recorded, except Alan Lomax did some extraordinary field work in the early 30s. But it wasn't a commercial entity, and really until about that time, and Clifton Chenier had already had a hit by the time I met him, but the one hit had sort of worn out when I met him, and he was absolutely almost insisting that I record him, that he wanted to get a record out back on the jukeboxes, because that was their meal ticket, you know. So he was really the main one that I recorded, because I wasn't sure if I could sell that type of thing. I met Clifton through Lightning Hopkins. They are cousins, you see. And I wasn't sure if I could sell it. I knew I could sell blues because my European clientele had already told me, you know, oh, we love these blues. And I was beginning to get an inkling of that because I was selling old 78s to Europe. That's how I actually made my first money to buy a tape recorder and stuff. But the other things, the French music, I wasn't too sure at all about.
Why don't we take a short break? Then we'll talk some more and play some more records. And my guest is Chris Strachwitz, who is the founder and head of Arhuli Records, a small label that features regional music from around the United States as well as music from other parts of the world. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Chris Strachwitz is my guest, and we're talking about regional music in the United States, which is what he records on his Arhuli record label. Let's play something by Fred McDowell. Now, this is also one of the early recordings that you made. He was a Mississippi blues guitarist and singer, and probably the most famous record that you recorded of his is You Gotta Move, which was later covered by the Rolling Stones.
Well, I guess that's the one that became famous because they did it, you know. And he was an extraordinary person. I was wiped away when I heard the Alan Lomax collection from Mississippi. And I remember I wrote to Alan Lomax, where is this man from? And he gave me an address in Clarksdale, Mississippi. And I went to the post office, where's Route So-and-So? He said, oh, it's out there, north of Highway 61. Go out there. And I met him just getting off a tractor. And I recorded that record there the same night. Not this particular one, but that first album. I don't think he sang You Got to Move on that first night we recorded, but what a wonderful person, Fred McDowell. He loved his music, and he was just as passionate about it as anybody I've ever encountered. And he would play on if you meet him. He didn't care if he's getting paid or not. He loved what he was doing. It was just a sheer joy, that man.
Let me play something that you recorded by him in 1965. This is You Gotta Move.
You got to move, you got to move, you got to move, child, you got to move. But when they're long, get ready, you got to move.
Fred McDowell singing You've Gotta Move. Now, this is a song attributed to Fred McDowell. Is it ever hard to tell who actually wrote a song, a blues song? Because there seems to be so many permutations of more or less the same song. And I found in books that I read that sometimes songs are attributed to different people, depending on who you're reading.
It's a real problem. In that particular instance, it's a traditional song, but the arrangement is by Fred McDowell. Reverend Gary Davis also had a very distinctive arrangement of it. But you sort of remind me of the fact that, you know, as I got into this whole music thing, one slowly begins to realize what responsibilities one has. And that was one of the early ones I think I encountered. This whole business of copywriting, because when you're recording someone or you're really capturing some of their talent, or you're capturing some of their ideas. People who write books, you know, okay, they go to a publisher and they have their books written and copywrote and all that. But these vernacular musicians don't, and so you're really responsible for protecting them. And I learned this really primarily from a good old buddy down in South Louisiana, Eddie Schuler. He once heard my tapes, you know, I played them to him, and he says, "Chris, what do you want that stuff for? Get their songs." I said, "What do you mean, get their songs? I got them right there on the tape." "No, man, that ain't what I'm talking about. Copyrights, get their copyrights. If Frank Sinatra or the Beatles want to make a big hit out of it, you know, then if you got the copyright, that's where you make the money, and you share that with the composer." So I kind of learned that, you know. You don't read that in books, but you begin to realize what responsibilities you have in life.
So how did you handle it on You Gotta Move?
You opened a can of worms. Okay. Mr. Klein, who was the manager of the Rolling Stones, he insisted, of course, that everything the Stones recorded was theirs. However, Mick Jagger was good enough to put on the first recording of that particular version that they did the name of Fred McDowell. They listed that as the composer on the Atlantic label. Okay, all hell broke loose. I said, "Fred, where did you learn this song?" He said, "Chris, I learned it out of a book." And then Manny Greenhill, who represented Reverend Gary Davis, called me, and he said, "Chris, you know Reverend Gary Davis wrote that song, not Fred McDowell." I says, "Manny, you and everybody else knows it's a traditional song. It's their various arrangements that may be worth copywriting here, you know." And so we finally headed out, and we agreed that as long as somebody would record Fred McDowell's version, which had that slide guitar, very eerie sort of thing, it would be mostly going to Fred McDowell. If they were recording the very finger-picked guitar style of Reverend Gary Davis's version, he would get most of the copyrights, but it is a traditional song, and I think all you can do is handle the arrangement of it. And Fred McDowell was, before he died, he was absolutely amazed. I handed him a check for over $7,000. He says, "Chris, I can't believe it, but I'm glad somebody out there likes my music."
Before we hear some more regional music, I want to ask you if you think there is still regional music.
Oh, yes, very, very, very much so.
You don't worry that it's kind of dying out and that things are becoming more homogenized
nationally?
No,
people always talk about that. You know, things change, but they don't die out. But I'm constantly amazed of, in spite of this extraordinary power that the media has over almost world culture now, you know, these things go on. They evolve, they multiply, it changes, but it's still very much regional things go on. Oh, yes.
Well, let's get to the border region and play some music of the Southwest. You have a film that you did along with Les Blank. It's called Chulas Fronteras.
Chulas Fronteras, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And
we did that. Oh, that's almost over 15 years ago, but it's still a classic.
Mm-hmm. Now, what kind of music are you playing on here?
This is what most people down there call conjunto music, but of course the Spanish word conjunto simply means group. In Cuba, they call groups conjuntos, etc. But down there in South Texas, it means a group that consists of button accordion, a bajo sexto, which is a big fat 12-string guitar, a bass, and drums usually. And that was the popular music at the time in the 60s. It still is pretty strong, but, you know, tastes do change and the kids go for something a little bit more modern, sort of schmaltzy nowadays. But conjunto music at its best was this absolutely powerful, powerful, vernacular music of that time and the place, you know. It still goes on strong, yeah.
Well, this is the Corinas Flaco Jimenez, and the song is Mojado Sin Licencia.
Mojado Sin Licencia, a wetback without a license. That was written by his father, the late Santiago Jimenez, yeah.
Okay, let's give it a listen.
Desde la arena.
Flaco Jimenez is recorded in the mid-1970s. Chris Drakowitz, what are some of the recent developments happening in border music now?
Well, it still goes on pretty much in that tradition, but they are also, a lot of the youngsters seem to like more the grupos, as they call them, you know, they use electric organs or synthesizers instead of the accordion, and, you know, things do change and so on, but they still play basically a lot of polkas, a lot of waltzes, because people love to dance, and it's still social dancing. It's not just hopping around like Flaco Jimenez once told me. He just came back from his first Anglo gig in Austin, and I said, how did it go? He said, man, those people dance, but they dance funny. They're like kangaroos. They hop around. So I think the music down there is strong. It goes on, and there are festivals now. There's a Conjunto Festival every year in San Antonio, done sponsored by the Guadalupe Cultural Center. It's a marvelous event. Every May, you should go.
You started collecting records back in the days of 78. You started making records with very, you know, pretty primitive tape recording equipment. Well, now we're in the CD era, the compact disc era, and you are reissuing some of your records on CD and issuing new records on compact disc. I'm wondering what kind of pressures it puts on a small company like yours to enter the CD age. I assume that it's a much more expensive format to put
out. You're right. Just about put me in my grave. I figured I'm either going to retire or get with it. And so I decided I'm going to get with it. So I've spent the last year literally working 12 hours a day trying to remaster stuff, trying to get money together to do this. I've just spent, I think, close to $150,000, which I had somehow saved up over the last 10 years, because I had a feeling something was going to happen. And so I'm in the CD era now, but it's a very expensive proposition and a time-consuming thing, because I don't want to just put out CDs that simply duplicate the LPs I did. I figure here is a new medium. I should start from scratch. I should go back to the original tapes, and I can make over 60-minute programs, you know, that just really represent the best of the stuff that I taped, and that's what I'm doing.
Do you find that record stores don't carry many albums anymore and that CDs are pushing out records?
Oh, yes, that's definitely. I mean, it's a total insane luxury to have three sound carriers. You know, that's just, it's ludicrous because it's not only time-consuming. I mean, when you have billion-dollar items, then I can see it. You know, they don't really care what form they issued on toothpaste boxes or on razor blades or whatever. But a little guy who only has so much time and money, it's murderous. I mean, I'm spending so much money and time just trying to, and every item like the cassette, the CD, I got to listen to it when it comes back, you know, to test it, make sure it's okay. The packaging, the little inserts, the booklets, you got to read it over again. I mean, it just takes time. And so I don't think the people out there should blame anybody except the guys who invent this stuff. So let's hope the CD hangs around for a while, but I know the chip is coming down the road. Who knows? Oh, boy, will the matchbox hold my clothes, huh?
Chris Drakowitz is celebrating the 30th anniversary of our Hooli Records this year. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, a look at life inside an inner-city high school, one that's ranked among the worst 10% of high schools in New York State. My guests will be Jessica Siegel, an English teacher, and Samuel Friedman, the journalist who spent a year observing and writing about her. I hope you can join us.
Luchan por separarnos, pero es inútil. Nuestro amor es tan grande como no habrá jamás.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer, providing the Fresh Air staff the power to be their best. This is NPR. National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. for She's Gotta Have It, School Days, Do the Right Thing, for all of Spike Lee's movies, Ernest Dickerson has been the man behind the camera. Dickerson's title is director of photography, but he often ends up directing when Spike Lee is acting. Coming up, Ernest Dickerson tells us about his ongoing collaboration with Spike Lee. And TV critic David Bianculli previews the Dave Thomas Comedy Show, premiering on CBS. You may remember Thomas from the comedy series SCTV. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Colombia's rigid bipartisan political system has received what one political analyst today called a healthy blow. Although the ruling Liberal Party candidate was elected president with 48% of the vote, an independent came in second, and the left received more votes than ever in the history of Colombia. Leslie Werpsa reports from Bogota.
President-elect Cesar Gaviria was not the only winner in yesterday's elections. Both the left and the far right gained political ground. Second-place contender Álvaro Gómez split the traditional conservative party and ran as an independent, netting 23% of the vote. The M19 Democratic Alliance also did remarkably well for a left-wing third party. The M19's Antonio Navarro received 12.6% of the votes, four times the left's usual tally of 3%. One political scientist said that the success of the left and of the right will be good for Colombia. Politics have been dominated by the liberals and the conservatives for over 100 years. Although the elections were hailed as a victory for democracy and a blow to drug terrorism, the abstention rate was the highest in the past 10 years. Around 60% of those able to vote did not. For National Public Radio, I'm Leslie Werpsa in Bogota.
After an all-night meeting with Solidarity leader Lech Wałęsa, striking railroad workers in Poland agreed today to end their walkout. The strike has paralyzed rail traffic in northwest Poland, and workers agreed to call off their plans for a nationwide boycott. The workers say that they are having to carry too much of the burden of their country's financial crisis because many goods are no longer being produced, leaving fewer transportation jobs. And the clock is ticking at the Kennedy Space Center toward an early morning Wednesday liftoff of the Space Shuttle Columbia. As Dave Pignanelli reports, preparations are proceeding smoothly, except for one glitch.
Technicians call it a heads-up display unit, or HUD. The computer allows astronauts to re-enter Earth's atmosphere and land without having to look outside of the space plane. The orbiter's attitude is adjusted according to HUD's display screen. That screen has been malfunctioning, however. Workers replaced the unit, but the problem would not go away. So technicians are now replacing the electronics package, which feeds the display unit. Work should be completed late tonight and is not expected to have any impact on the launch schedule. Columbia is scheduled to leave its Cape Canaveral launch pad at 12:38 a.m. Eastern Time Wednesday. It will spend 10 days in Earth orbit, measuring ultraviolet light and X-rays with four telescopes that are bolted inside the shuttle's cargo bay. For National Public Radio, I'm Dave Pignanelli reporting.
In New York City, the stock market is closed today after ending last week on the downside. The Dow Jones Industrials dropped over 34.5 points Friday after advancing about 3.6% over the last 3 weeks. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. Last year's most controversial film was Spike Lee's Do the Right Thing, but most people are in agreement that the film was beautifully shot by Ernest Dickerson. Dickerson was the cinematographer on Spike Lee's two other features, She's Gotta Have It and School Days, and he also shot Lee's new film, Mo' Better Blues, which is due out this summer. I spoke with Dickerson a few months ago while the new film was still being edited. We talked about his collaborations with Spike Lee, and he told me how they first met.
Well, we met in film school. Our first year at New York University Graduate School of Film and Television. And although we really didn't work together in the first year because we were in two separate classes, we talked and saw a lot of movies together and pretty much planned on working together as soon as we could, which was in second year of graduate school. Spike was a directing and a writing major, and I was a cinematography major. And we've worked together ever since.
Together with Spike Lee, you've made films about black people, with black actors, with largely black crews. Is it important to you to do that?
Well, yeah. Actually, the crews have been pretty much 50-50. Mm-hmm. They've been pretty integrated. Yeah, it is important for us, especially in the crews, because most of the time there's a lot of qualified black technicians who are mostly shut out when it comes to the crewing up process for a lot of different reasons. We've found that, you know, people have come to town looking for, you know, black people to put on their crew, and for one reason or another, producers told them they couldn't find anybody, even though the town is full of them.
Were you ever worried about being shut out yourself?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure it's happened. I've gotten some pretty lame excuses for not hiring me. I've been told my work is too pretty. I was even turned down for a job one time because the producer wasn't sure if I could photograph a tree. That's what he told me. The film was taking place in the country. And most of what he had seen of my work was in, you know, in the urban environment. And he wasn't too sure if I could photograph a tree. Those were his words.
How long ago was this?
This was about 3-4 years ago. I still get shut out for various reasons. Sometimes the director wants me, and sometimes the producer wants somebody else, and they'll tell the producer that I'm unavailable, they'll tell the director I'm unavailable, even though I am. So I've found that out several times, much to my dismay.
Mm-hmm. The movies that you've made with Spike Lee have also starred Spike Lee. What's the difference for you as the director of photography when Spike Lee is in the shot and when he's not in the shot?
Well, when he's in front of the camera, he needs an objective eye to kind of co-direct him through his performances and keep an eye on what he's not able to see because he's in front of the camera, and that's the job that I have. It puts a little bit more responsibility on me because I usually have to, you know, concentrate on performance as well. Spike does put a lot on me usually in terms of designing the look of the films and also designing entire sequences shot by shot. But when he's in front of the camera, then in a way I almost have to step into the director's chair for a few minutes.
That must be really good for you. I mean, it's another challenge to take on.
Yeah, well, I like it. I mean, it's prevented me from just looking at any of his films as just a job. I mean, I get more involved than I imagine the average cinematographer might.
The first time you worked with him on camera, were you surprised at the amount of presence that he had, film presence?
Yeah, you know, it's amazing because it's the kind of thing you really don't see at first. When he first did that, it was on She's Gotta Have It. And he did it mainly because he couldn't afford anybody else. And we always thought of it as kind of a joke because Spike was the last person we thought we'd want to get in front of the camera. And then finally, after it was all over and we started seeing the film cut together, that's when we started seeing what was going on there. And he definitely stole the show. And a lot of people were surprised to find out that he was Spike Lee. Several times I saw it with an audience, and they knew that Spike Lee was in it, and they knew that Spike Lee directed it. And at the end, he shows all the actors, and they go through their, you know, they announce their names, their own names. And at the end, he says, Spike Lee, and everybody in the audience said, that's Spike Lee? It was kind of funny.
Did they think he'd be one of the taller, more conventionally good-looking guys in the film?
Yeah, I guess that most of them probably thought he was Tommy Hicks.
Mm-hmm. Your skills have grown as the budgets of your films have grown. Do the Right Thing was, I think, the first movie that you and Spike Lee did together that had a union crew. How does having a union crew affect your job and what you could depend on others to do and what you have to do yourself?
Well, actually, we did have a union crew on School Days, even though it was shot non-union in a right-to-work state, but most of the people were members of the NABUT local down there.
I see.
It's not so much the union crew, because there are a lot of good non-union crews in town. It was the money to give us more time to do things the way we really wanted to do them. If you don't have enough time to really perfect a shot or a sequence, a lot of times you're rushing and you get whatever you can in the time that you have. on Do the Right Thing, we had 10 weeks of shooting, which was very comfortable. And it enabled me to do a lot of things. I had more control over the image. If the light wasn't exactly right, we had time to wait for it, which was something I had always considered a luxury. Sometimes if the light wasn't right, I had time to build the light. I mean, there were several days where we had rainy days, and I had to make it look like sun. And doing something like that takes time, and we had the time to do that with. That's the thing that more money gives you.
How do you make a rainy day look like sun?
Well, I used a combination of brute arcs, which I still think is the closest approximation of sunlight. It's a big light. It's made by an arc that's passed between electrical arc, a spark that's actually passed between two carbon rods, and it's the texture of the light is the closest to sunlight I've ever seen.
Mm-hmm.
There's one scene in the beginning of the movie where some folks are sitting on the stoop and they first meet Radio Raheem. What I did was to cover over the entire stoop area with big reflectors. And I bounced blue light into the white of the reflectors to simulate like blue light coming from a blue sky. And then with the arcs coming, simulating hard sunlight and just careful balancing it. I look at it today and I think it's one of the things I'm proudest about the film is that I was able to really achieve sunlight. It looks like sunlight, I think.
Mm-hmm. Now, you're telling us that you work closely with Spike Lee in designing the look of a film. Can you talk a little bit about designing the look of Do the Right Thing?
Yeah. Well, long before Spike had the story nailed down, he told me he wanted to do something that took place on the hottest day of the year. He wanted to highlight the fact that he had read that the murder rate rises on very hot days. That on hot days, the tempers are short, nerves afraid, people are like very nervous, the heat just like aggravates the smallest thing. And he wanted to, you know, he wanted to convey that visually. And he talked to me about ways of doing it. What I figured was that we had to limit the color scale, stay away from cool colors, really hone in more on the yellows and reds, the warm part of the spectrum, and also play with various degrees of overexposure to get the feeling of glare,
mm-hmm.
you know, especially at midday. Also, since the script took place in one day, I also had to show how the light changes in the course of the day. The light goes from very low in the sky in the morning, you know, usually a warmer light, to very glary, hard, hot light at midday. And then back into like a warmer, softer, redder light at the end of the day.
Cinematographer Ernest Dickerson is my guest, and we're talking about his work with filmmaker Spike Lee. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Cinematographer Ernest Dickerson is my guest, and we're talking about his work on Spike Lee's film, Do the Right Thing. I want to ask you a question about the most controversial scene in the movie, and this is the scene where Danny Aiello breaks Radio Raheem's boombox, and the fight that they're having becomes, you know, erupts into a riot. From everything I've read about the making of the film, Danny Aiello didn't like the way that scene was initially written and didn't much like the way his role was written, and he expanded on it. He put in a lot more biography about the character and everything. During the period when he and Spike Lee were discussing how this character should be and how that scene should be played out, where were you? Did you participate in that discussion, or did you just kind of keep away until that's resolved between director and actor?
Yeah, that's a very personal conversation between director and actor. Spike and Danny worked that out between themselves in rehearsals and all their conferences, talking about who the character is and where he goes, how he develops. I'm not usually privy to that. But a lot of times I see it happening on the set, and sometimes, you know, an actor will ask me a second opinion about what I'm seeing.
Now, you just wrapped a film. The film's initial title was Love Supreme. I don't really know what it's being called now.
It's called The Mo Better Blues.
And it stars, I believe, Denzel Washington as a jazz musician.
Mm-hmm.
Can you just fill us in a little bit more on what the basic premise of the movie is?
Basic premise is, I think it's a dilemma that a lot of artists go through. When your devotion to your art gets in the way of your personal life, and vice versa. He's a trumpeter. He's devoted to his music. He makes no bones about telling the two ladies in his life that his music comes first. And naturally, they have problems with that.
Now, how did you prepare to shoot this movie?
One of the things that we did, spent a lot of time with the art director, as usual. I think it's very important to have a good rapport with a production designer, because he's the guy or the girl that's going to put the put those things out there that you're going to photograph. I always work with him to discuss the colors that are being used in the sets. I believe in controlling color and controlling the palette of the film. You discuss lighting in locations and things like that. An example is there's a major set that was built is called the Club Underdog. And one of the things I worked out with him was letting the club light itself as much as possible, so that when we went in, most of the work was already, or most of the lighting was already integrated into the design of the club. And, you know, it's things like this that help you get the look of a film. You really have to work closely with a production designer and the costume designer.
Since this film is about a jazz musician, did you go back and watch any classic jazz films?
No classic jazz films. We looked at a lot of jazz photography, especially of the 40s, 50s, and 60s. We went through a lot of books. There was a book that I've had for years. It's a book called Jazz Street by a photographer named Dennis Stock. And it's all black and white. Photographs of jazz musicians backstage, at work, even portraits, documentary-type stuff in clubs. I mean, really beautiful photography. And I looked at that quite a bit to give me an inspiration for the feeling of the club and different musical numbers.
Mm-hmm. When you were back in school and you were learning about film lighting, were a lot of the lighting techniques that you were taught really designed to light white skin, white faces?
Yeah. The whole exposure system is based around Caucasian tone. But before I went to film school, I studied still photography. I minored in color photographic illustration at Howard University. And most of the models that I photographed were black. So even then, I had started working out my own methods, my own exposure methods for black folks.
How different is it?
I don't feel it's that different, probably because it's, I think it's become second nature to me now. It's basically placing the values, the skin, the tonal values, where I want them. It's also a combination of makeup also, because one of the things you don't want to do is dull black skin too much, especially dark skin, because you cut down its reflectivity if you do that. So actually a light moisturizer in the skin is usually required, and I usually talk that over with the makeup person.
Mm-hmm. Any other different considerations?
It depends upon the situation. It depends upon if the black actor is in the same scene with a white actor. Sometimes that can be problematical because if you have to put a little bit more light on the black actor, then it'll burn out the white actor. So sometimes it comes into using nets to just shade and try and achieve a balance between the two.
Earlier in our conversation, you said that you thought that there was a time when you were shut out, that you weren't given offers that you thought you perhaps would have been given had you not been black. Do you still feel that way? I mean, your films are really getting very well known and are very successful. Do you still feel that you're being shut out from certain films?
Well, I'm not turning down work yet.
Uh-huh.
I mean, you know, I interview for projects that I think I'm ideal for. And usually I'm given an indication that they'd really like to use my services, but a lot of the times I'm not used. So I get that, but then I get calls from people that you know, insist that I shoot their production. So it goes both ways.
Well, I wish you the best with your new films, and I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Cinematographer Ernest Dickerson shot Spike Lee's forthcoming film, Mo' Better Blues, which will open this summer. This is Fresh Air.
Hello, it's Noah Adams from National Public Radio's All Things Considered. Coming up today, we'll talk with an Armenian spokesman in Yerevan, Armenia. More than 20 people there have been killed in clashes with Soviet Interior Ministry troops. The Arab nations get together for a summit meeting in Baghdad. I'll talk with Ross Terrell in Beijing. The first anniversary of the Tiananmen Square massacre is a week away. Terrell says China seems occupied with the Asian Games coming up in Beijing in September, but that the pro-democracy movement hasn't gone away. He does not, though, expect any protests on the Tiananmen anniversary. Also, a trash count and cleanup on America's beaches, and from the South African townships, the music of Malatini and the Mahotela Queens. That's an All Things Considered from National Public Radio.
Back in January, Dave Thomas of the old SCTV comedy series headlined his own variety special. Beginning this week, Thomas returns, and his special gets a 5-week run as a summer fill-in series on CBS. TV critic David Bianculli has this review.
Good evening, I'm Dave Thomas, and welcome to a new primetime comedy show. Some of you may recognize me from late-night television. I did a show called SCTV for a few years.
Of course we remember you for that, Dave. SCTV was one of the brightest, funniest, and boldest shows of the 70s and early 80s. Even though Saturday Night Live got most of the glory, SCTV did most of the best work. Thomas, John Candy, Catherine O'Hara, Andrea Martin, Rick Moranis, Martin Short, and the rest, well, everybody was just great. The Dave Thomas Comedy Show takes a faster, flashier approach, more like MTV than SCTV. Not that I necessarily mind that Thomas has replaced the extended and complicated satire of SCTV with the shorter, sillier sketches of the old Second City stage shows. But the closest Thomas comes to the old SCTV style is the opening sketch. It's a takeoff on The Equalizer, with Thomas imitating the voice of Edward Woodward and the words of Dirty Harry.
Stop or I'll speak. The rest of you vermin, stay where you are. or I'll unleash the full fury of my natural English flair for rhetorical invective.
What'd he say? Shut up, man!
I know what you're thinking. Did I use 5 big words or did I use 6? Well, in all the excitement, I seem to have forgotten myself. But being as I'm a veritable walking thesaurus and could, through the use of sesquipedalian verbiage, reduce you to a sniveling, speechless wretch, the question you have to ask yourself is, do I feel lucky? Well, do you, punk?
Most of the Dave Thomas Comedy Show, though, isn't about satirizing TV and movies. Like the Tracy Ullman Show, it's more about creating its own comic characters and situations. The funniest skit, in the first show, has Thomas as a meek little businessman harassed by a co-worker, played by guest star and former SCTV co-star John Candy. The action takes place at the office water fountain, but the attitude is pure playground.
Do you mind?
Mind what?
I'm trying to get a drink.
Are you?
Yeah.
Are you?
Yeah.
Oh. And am I in your way?
Yeah, you're in my way.
Come on. In your way.
You're in my way.
I'm sorry. Hugh, I'm sorry. I didn't know I was in your way. Here, let me help you.
Come on, Gary.
You come on, Hugh.
Funny.
Come on, have a drink.
Okay.
I'll get it for you. Ready?
Oh,
no tricks.
Okay.
Ready?
Yeah. That's not very funny.
Oh, I thought it was.
Well, I didn't.
I thought it was very funny. Are those your papers?
Yes, they are.
They're on the ground.
Look, you dropped your papers. Them.
Come on, guys. This really isn't funny. Oh.
Actually, it is. But like many of the skits in this show, it loses steam before the end. The Dave Thomas Comedy Show is filled with a lot of good ideas, but it's also filled with a lot of filler. And when Thomas does his opening monologue as himself, he's a lot less funny than when he imitates Bob Hope doing one of his monologues. This show has talent to spare, and it is fun to watch. It's just that I'm kind of disappointed because I know Thomas can do better. Maybe in the next 4 installments, he will.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Post. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Thad Kirk, Richard Parker, Ron Barron, Dan Lachlan, and Joyce Lieberman. Chris Burgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, by this and other NPR member stations, and by a grant from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-225-8200. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we meet the writer and director of the new film Longtime Companion. It's about the impact of AIDS on a circle of gay men. Also, life inside one of New York's inner-city high schools with teacher Jessica Siegel and journalist Sam Friedman, who wrote a book about her. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.